From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South.
One morning, she wheeled me out onto the front porch, and the rickety old chair collapsed. That was a sign to her that it was time for me to get up and start walking.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
As a matter of fact, I don't think I'd ever seen any sheep in Saline County. Oh, I'm sure they were here. It was just we didn't run in the same circles.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
Now, I will admit, there may be another explanation of her acting so strangely. Phantom adored Scotch whiskey.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Tonight's music by the Salty Dogs. What y'all think? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on the road tonight, on location in Saline County, Arkansas, at the First United Methodist Church in Benton, with all of our storytellers tonight from right here in Saline County. We have an incredible audience of over 300 people. Our biggest live audience to date. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? On tonight's show, Our writers remember those that are hard to forget, whether they knew them for years or just a few months. All stories are true and told by the Saline County Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Carrie McWilliams is left a note by a neighbor she met only briefly, and will end the night with Sam Gibson as he remembers a very interesting family member. But let's start the night with Sam Taggart as he opens his door and in walks a patient he'll never forget in Don't Trust Doctors Much.
Many years ago, as a young family doctor, I moved to Benton and put out my shingle. Charlie Burnett, an old man with a gimpy hip, his words, not mine, came walking into my office. I remember him being old, but when I do the math, he was approximately 10 years younger than I am right now. "I'm here to try you out," he said. I nodded. "Gotta warn you, I don't trust doctors much." Again, I nodded. "I guess you noticed I have a limp." "Yes, sir, I did. How did that become a problem?" I asked. He smiled and corrected me. "Son, my hip's not a problem. It's a reminder." Needless to say, that was not the response I was expecting. Then he continued, "And it's the main reason that I don't believe doctors when they start making predictions." This time it was my turn to smile. "Tell me about it," I said. "Well, you see, I was an 18-year-old kid. I had been to Lewis Lumber to pick up supplies for my father. I was driving the family wagon pulled by an old, very unpleasant mule named Jake. We were crossing the railroad track just beyond Edison Avenue, and off in the distance, I heard the train whistle. I urged the mule to speed up, and instead of moving ahead, he balked. No amount of coaxing on my part could coerce that stubborn, stupid mule into moving from the track. As the train bore down on us, I jumped from the wagon and desperately pulled at the mule to get him and the wagon off of the track. I remember thinking that Daddy was going to kill me if anything happened to that mule. In the end, I got tangled up in the reins, and when the train struck, it killed the mule, demolished the wagon, and drug me about a quarter mile down the track. When everything came to a stop, the bystanders loaded my mangled, unconscious body into the back of the wagon and took me to the house. Mama cleaned me up, put me to bed, and sent one of my younger brothers to get the doctor. Several hours later, the old doctor came to the house to see if there was anything he could do for me. After he examined me, he turned to my mother. "This boy won't survive the night." He gave her a bottle of medicine for any pain that I might have and then left. My family later told me that Mama hardly moved from my bedside for several days. Well, as you can see, I made it through the night. And in a few days, I regained consciousness. I'm not quite sure when I realized that no one expected me to survive. But looking into the eyes of my parents, I knew they didn't. I remember thinking, "I'm not ready for my life to be over. And this is not how my story ends." The train had crushed my right hip and pelvis, injured my bladder, but it left my colon and my spine intact. As the swelling went down all around, all the organs started doing what they were supposed to be doing. The doctor came back in a couple of weeks and looked me over. His comment was, "He may live, but he'll never walk." What the doctor wasn't counting on was the combination of my mama and me. That woman was the fingertip of God. She was the best nurse that has ever lived, and I was determined to survive. She had Daddy build me an old makeshift wheelchair, and despite my pain, she made me get up out of bed. One morning, she wheeled me out onto the front porch, and the rickety old chair collapsed. That was a sign to her that it was time for me to get up and start walking. A year later, I hobbled into the office of that old doctor. "Yeah, but you'll never be able to hold down a job." We had a little bit of family land down in Saline River Bottoms, and for the next 25 years, I farmed cotton and corn. When the aluminum company built the big plant and bauxite, they put in a water relift station on the river, and I ran that for them. Right before I left that day, the doctor looked at me and said, "Even if you can work, you'll never be able to have children." By the way, that was the last time I ever saw that doctor. With that, Charlie stopped talking. He smiled and sat silently. He had said his piece. I realized it was my turn to say something, but actually there was nothing for me to say. Instead, I just held my hand out and we shook hands. He and I became good friends, and I learned a lot from that old man and his gimpy hip. The last time I saw Charlie was just before he died in his early 90s. I made a house call to see him, and when I drove up, there were cars and people everywhere. Most of them were his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Tears came to my eyes as I sat there in my truck watching all of them say their final goodbyes. I remembered his first words to me: don't trust doctors much when they go to making predictions. Thank you.
Sam Taggart is a family physician, novelist, and playwright. His most recent play, Nobody's Business, will premiere at the Royal Theater in Benton, Arkansas on August 16, 2012. In our next story, Carrie McWilliams meets a neighbor only briefly, but she's reminded of him each spring in Sheep.
One spring day in about 2001, while out in the backyard with my kids, I heard the crunch of gravel and the barking of dogs. Before I was able to get to the front yard, a young man dressed in a business suit appeared in our backyard. "Your sheep's loose," he said. At this point in our family farm's timeline, it was exclusively a cow, mostly Black Angus place. We've since expanded with a handful of chickens and ducks. My husband Clark's family had owned and worked this farm for over 40 years. But me, having lived on a farm for no more than 6 years, I knew I didn't have all the little nuances of country living down pat. But I jolly well knew the difference between a cow and a sheep. I also knew that we didn't own any sheep, nor did any of our neighbors. As a matter of fact, I don't think I'd ever seen any sheep in Sling County. Oh, I'm sure they were here. It was just we didn't run in the same circles. "You mean there's a cow on the road?" I said. "No, ma'am, it's a sheep, and I'll help you catch it if you need me to." So my choices of responses were, "No, thank you, I can catch this sheep that isn't mine that I've never seen before by myself," or, "Yes, please." Truth be told, how could I possibly pass up a man in a suit chasing a sheep down my road? So change that to, "Yes, please, but let me get my camera first." Suit man and I were able to secure the sheep in a small paddock close to the road. After Clark got home from work that day, he and I were able to make a few observations about sheep. Sheep are not cows. They don't act, nor do they look like, cows. Sheep are not contained by barbed wire fencing. The fences act more like a filter. It will retain a cow while sheep seem to pass right through. Cows think a sheep is the devil. A herd of 40 strong will bunch up at the far end of a field like a bunch of crybabies at the sight of a sheep. After several days of the sheep terrorizing the cows, we worked out a system by tethering the sheep to a tree and supplying the sheep with a bucket of water. The only place that it would work, meaning the only place there weren't any cows, was in our front yard. This made it handy to keep an eye on the sheep, as well as ensuring that the sheep was visible from Brazel Road. We had no desire to go into the sheep business, and we were certain that the sheep's owner would notice a missing sheep, which, I have yet to mention, was a big ram, horns and all. Our children were delighted with the sheep. He was somewhat friendlier than our cows, and he was certainly exotic. Clark was more worried than delighted. The days had turned into weeks, and a hot Arkansas summer was upon us. The thought of spending June and July in my front yard with a long wool coat on sounded like animal cruelty. Plus, where were this guy's owners? I'm still not sure if we made the decision to shear the sheep out of compassion or out of curiosity, but I managed to track down a pair of old-fashioned wool shears. They cost close to $20, which seemed a bit pricey for what was likely to be a one-time use. I discussed it with my mother and showed her the shears. Upon seeing them, she got all nostalgic and said, "Oh, those are just like the kind my daddy had." I said, "I didn't know you all had sheep." "We didn't," she said. "Daddy used them to trim the edge of the sidewalk." Clark sheared while I took pictures. I still have a picture of that bloody, ragged beast. The sheep didn't fare much better. I know he felt better, and my goodness, he looked about 50 pounds lighter. The sheep, not Clark. Sometime in July, a pleasant man, Mr. X, knocked at our door and inquired about the sheep, his sheep. It turned out Mr. X rarely, if ever, drives down Brazel Road to get to town, and he wasn't aware that the sheep had taken refuge with us. A friend of his, who knew that Mr. X was missing his ram, spotted the sheep on his way to work and sent Mr. X to us. It was quite a reunion. It turns out that Mr. X had recently moved here from up north and was attempting to pretty much live off of the land, so he and his family were somewhat secluded. Additionally, he was Jewish, which explained why we hadn't seen Mr. X and his family at the First Methodist Church services. On the appointed day, Mr. X, his wife, and his two children showed up in their Volvo sedan. We all pushed, pulled, and cajoled the sheep into the back seat. At that moment, Clark and I retired from the sheep herding business. Several days later, I found an envelope on my front porch. In it, I found a lovely thank you, an invitation to dinner, written in a lovely script and adorned with beautiful scrollwork. "You shall not see your kinsman ox or sheep driven astray without showing concern about it. See to it that it is returned to your kinsman. If this kinsman does not live near you, or you do not know who he may be, take it to your own place and keep it with you until he claims it. Then give it back to him." Deuteronomy 22, 1 and 2. We've not seen Mr. X or his family since that summer. As long ago as that was, I still revisit the memory each spring when I edge my sidewalk with my shears.
Carrie McWilliams lives on a farm in Saline County, Arkansas. She and her husband are still retired from the sheep herding business. In our final story of the night, Sam Gibson's rescue makes a lasting impression in Reminiscences of Phantom.
It was a cold winter morning when my daughter Helen hopped into her car in the garage to warm it up so she could make it on time to her senior classes at Benton High School. I was in the kitchen when I heard her scream. I rushed through the garage door. My adrenaline was just racing through my veins. I ran into the driveway. The cold air hit my bare arms. Helen by now was out of the car and crying hysterically as she wrestled with the hood latch. "Phantom," she sobbed. I heard her squeal when I turned on the car. I think she's inside the engine. 3 months earlier, Helen had found a pure white kitten and her brown sister abandoned by the side of the road. We soon settled on the names Bomber for the brown kitten and Phantom for the white kitten. My 15-year-old son had suggested those names. His version of each name was wordier and really wasn't fit for polite conversation. Unfortunately, a household with teenage drivers and preoccupied adults was not the safest of places for young kittens to roam about. Bomber had not survived her explorations of the garage and driveway, and now it looked as if Phantom might succumb to the same fate. Phantom had apparently discovered that the engine of my daughter's car was a warm place to sleep in the pre-dawn hours. Sure enough, Helen had started her car with Phantom still under the hood. I was able to get the kitten out, but a moving part had struck Phantom's head hard enough that I thought for sure we had lost her. Much to our surprise and relief, however, Phantom recovered from the blow to her head. She never again tried to sleep in a parked car. But what we got in return was some very odd kitten behavior. For instance, from time to time, she would start walking across the den in our home, get about halfway, and just stop. She'd look around as if she were completely mystified as to why she was crossing the room. Then she would lie down on the spot and stay there for a while. Sometimes she would get up and continue in the original direction of her trek, and sometimes she'd arise and return the way she had come. Other times, Phantom displayed hunting instincts and cunning that caused me to think her odd behavior was just odd and not necessarily damaged. We had a spiral staircase in our living room. My path from the kitchen to the living room passed under those stairs. Phantom learned which stair was just higher than the top of my head. She would lie on that stair, and as I walked under her, she would slap down with a forepaw, grabbing my hair. That never failed to startle me. And I believe the cat took a great delight in seeing me jump away from her. Then there was the going outside for her personal needs routine. She would usually sleep on the bed with me. Then first thing each morning, I would open the door from the bedroom to the deck and toss Phantom out. When the weather was especially bad, with rain falling or with snow on the deck, Phantom could actually twist around in midair and land on the doormat facing back at me. She would sit there on that doormat, staring through the glass door, just glaring at me, until she was convinced that I wasn't immediately going to let her back in. Then she'd go tend to her outdoor needs, and we would continue with our day. After the head injury, Phantom's dining habits were, let's say, interesting. There was a large turtle who would from time to time share meals with her on the back deck. One evening, I heard a noise that drew my attention to the place where Phantom usually ate outside. She was having her meal, and a possum was standing nearby, hissing loudly. Apparently, the possum didn't understand sharing, and he wanted the food bowl all to himself. Phantom continued to eat serenely. I'm sure she was willing to share, but just not willing to wait until after the possum had eaten to have her own meal. Now, I will admit, there may be another explanation of her acting so strangely. Phantom adored Scotch whiskey. If I set a glass down and turned away, she would have her face in the glass in an instant. Even, and maybe especially, when I wasn't aware she was in the room. Over time, it became less of a game and more of a contest of wills to keep Phantom out of the scotch. So whether it was a blow to her head, lapse of scotch, or a combination of both, I guess I'll never know. When Phantom was about 6 years old, she and I had a couple of the biggest adventures of our respective lives. I went to war in Kuwait and Iraq, and Phantom went to live in my girlfriend Pam's apartment in Little Rock. Not only did Phantom become an indoor-only cat, she got a new feline roommate. Tabitha had been the sole mistress of her domain in that apartment for years, with only one person to serve as her staff. And she did not take kindly to sharing. Phantom had lived all her life around other animals and lots of people. The feline negotiations about how to live together were not always civil. However, Phantom soon discovered that Tabitha had been declawed. So Phantom would just sit still, pointedly ignoring her, as Tabitha hissed and screamed and swatted until all her fury was spent. Eventually, the two reached a fragile truce, but it would be stretching the truth for me to say that those cats ever became friends. When I returned from Iraq, Pam and I married. We moved into a craftsman-style home on a busy street. Often, Phantom would spend her day sitting in a front window of that house. Several people commented to me how they enjoyed seeing that big white cat sitting in the window. However, I knew she wasn't just showing off for passersby. You see, Phantom never learned to understand glass. And to her great frustration, we had a squirrel at that house who understood glass perfectly. The squirrel would smugly place himself on the brick windowsill, just inches from Phantom, but on the other side of the glass. I've watched the squirrel turn his hind quarter to Phantom, rise up on tippy toes, and shake his tail right in her face. She would fling herself against the window repeatedly trying to get to the squirrel, but she was always thwarted by the window pane. I wish I could have opened that window for her with the squirrel still there, even just once. In the late 90s, I went off to war again. This time we called it peacekeeping in Bosnia. While I was there, Pam called me to let me know that Phantom had passed away. I thought about Phantom as that tiny kitten, then her overcoming an injury that surely should have killed her. I thought of all the interesting behaviors, and I wondered how many of them was just who she was. And then I hung up the phone. I smiled, knowing that Phantom had found a warm place to sleep, an open window, and a shot of scotch waiting for her when she got home.
Sam Gibson practices law in Benton with his wife, Pamela, and is a retired U.S. Army Reserve Brigadier General. He has two children and four grandchildren, all of whom are good-looking, bright, and accomplished. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Benton's First United Methodist Church. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.